up this morning with the sundown shining in. Oh.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
Oh, it's, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the news.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what
stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Well, hold on, back Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jim Lawler on the board. S&P futures down 23. NASDAQ futures down 282. As we're still fighting in the Strait of Hormuz, they say it's closed. We say it's open. I don't know if we're doing this right. Matter of fact, I'm thinking maybe we aren't, but we'll see. I mean, maybe it'll end up okay. But I'm starting to get a little more worried about it. Do we have Mr. John?
Yeah, well, come on now. I don't think anyone thinks this is a good idea. Well,
no,
one guy did, but he's not with us anymore.
Yeah, yeah,
he
didn't make it this week through the weekend. Well, I think he was probably one of the few guys that actually could once in a while talk to a Democrat. I don't know if anybody on either side of the aisle talks to each other, but Dick Durbin said he was a guy you could talk to, so I believe him. Plus, I don't really like it when anybody dies suddenly.
Well, have you noticed one thing is that there? Well, there was an article, I think, in the Wall Street Journal this morning or yesterday that you know this raises the age debate. And I went, wait a minute, Lindsey Graham was 71 years old.
Yeah,
he was not that old.
No.
I mean, I thought that he, you know, he's not 78. I mean, I'm just using that as a.
Yeah, but if it turns out if you were 78, you'd say 80, he's not 82.
That was an interesting statement. What's that?
I said if you were 78, you'd say he's not 82.
Yeah, but then again, I'm unique. You know, I'm different.
But I mean, if
I'm not like the rest of you guys, I'm not getting older. I'm getting younger.
If you're of sound mind and body, and you actually think are thinking straight, and I don't know at what age. I mean, obviously, I would guess if you're 105. But I suppose there has been a guy who was 105 that actually could think straight. I mean, I don't know what you... Everybody picks an age comfortably older than them when they talk about stuff like this.
Well, I think, but, you know, I mean, 70 is not... I mean, it's not middle-aged, for sure. But it's... I mean, we're not talking, you know, 80... It's not... It's not that, but I was frankly surprised he was. For some reason, I just thought he was much older.
No, and he was in good shape until his stuff happened.
There was an article that he was by McCain's daughter, that I guess McCain himself and Lieberman. And now that's a name I have not heard for a long time. We're very close. They call themselves the Three Amigos.
Well, he. The thing that I was somewhat impressed about is that I was looking at his, you know, I don't know why, I didn't dig into it, it just popped up. His net worth was like $1.5 to $2.5 million. So he basically just made his money on his Senate salary. I mean, he had like a couple of investments, but he wasn't spending all day trading like some of these other knuckleheads.
Tom, I'm going to dial back in. You're breaking up on me.
All right, I blame Jimmy. You know, who knows? But no,
blame Jimmy.
Why don't you dial back in?
Of course, I'm going to get blamed.
Well, why not? You know, you take the credit, you take the blame, as they say.
I take no credit, therefore I take no blame.
Well, how about this? We actually have Matt Byrne on the board now. So, Meta's Louisiana data center investment to reach $50 billion. Aided by generous tax incentives. And we've got this governor of Louisiana who, I think they gave them a 20-year sales tax buy, essentially. How the hell do you do that? 20 years? how, I mean, we talk on the show a lot about, you know, whoever happens to be in office, whatever the last buffoons we've had in office, all they do is talk about small business, and yet they can't wait to give every advantage to big business. How does that help small and mid business when you, every time somebody else comes in and they say to you, "Ah, Jim, you know, it's going to cost you X for your property taxes." All of a sudden, somebody else comes in, shoves a few shekels in my back pocket, and I go, "Ah, this guy's so big, we're not going to charge him any property taxes." How does that make you feel, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's just how it works. I mean, because then big business, very simply is going to say, you know, give me a tax grace. By the way, you know, that guy next to me, Mississippi, is willing to give me this.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
My question is, what does that do if you're actually asking for the system that we have designed for 250 years? What does that do to going out and getting, you know, credit here, getting something somewhere else? You know, what does that do to people making their decisions as to whether they're going to invest here? If you incent one person and disincent 300 others, are you gaining or losing?
Probably losing, but, you know.
Well, isn't that what we're worried about, that we're losing?
Well, I don't know. You had asked me a question earlier before the show about, according to AI, if you were a British soccer fan, you would have gone around the world 25,500 miles, and the cost to see all the games so far would be $8,500.
That's just in tickets?
Yes. It says that the tickets are about $60 per ticket per one source. The total amount could be higher. It doesn't take in...
Could anybody have gotten the tickets for $60?
I have no idea.
This is a question. I don't expect you to have the answer on the top of your head, but I've heard, you know, before the U.S., Mexico, and Canada were all out, the ticket price came down dramatically after all three host teams were out, allegedly. But you heard prices of, you know, $2,000 a ticket, those kinds of things. What was the face? Does anybody have any idea?
No, I don't. I know before the World Cup, the highest ticket was almost $200,000 at Met Stadium in New York, and that was a couple rows behind one of the goals.
Yeah, I mean, I did see that. I don't know if they were traded there or they were just offered there. I mean,
that is true.
I mean, who knows? But I mean, the question was, if one of the final teams actually came over here. I mean, if you wandered over from France and said, "Okay, I'm going to watch my team," where did you start? Where did you have to go? If you started in Mexico City, you couldn't very well just rent a car and drive to Seattle. So the question was, how many miles did you go from Mexico City to SoFi to Seattle? Which, I guess, well, once you get on a plane, you get on and you get off. I guess it doesn't matter much how long you're on there, but. Did somebody have to go from Seattle to Miami or Atlanta, or could it even have been done by car? I think the answer to that's probably no.
No, I don't know if you could do it by car. I mean, the games were a week apart. Now they're not. The game that just finished up on Saturday, they're playing on Wednesday. So,
well, you could make it from Mexico City to Seattle in a week if you wanted to by car. You got to be armed for the first few hundred miles, but
yeah,
I don't even know. I guess I could ask Salvador what would it be like to drive to Mexico. I know his family, as the town they come from, is not that far from Mexico City, and his sons have driven back and forth. I don't know how deaf-defying that is.
It's 2 days down to the border. Okay, two solid days. It's about a 24 hours total, but down to the border in Texas is roughly 2 days, because I looked at doing that, a visit friend. And Mexico City, I think, is at least another 8 hours. Let's look it up.
Well, all right. So, John, when you were off, we were talking about tax incentives given by the governor of Louisiana to this new Meta place. And the idea of tax incentives,
mean to that it's what, an AI?
Meta's $50 billion AI. And they evidently have partnered with somebody. But they've gotten a 20-year break on sales tax. Now, I don't know what that means. Well, I guess I know what it means, that they can... what sales tax does AI pay? I guess is my question. I have no idea. It's probably a Carl question. Here's one. India's inflation accelerates to 4.4% in June, exceeding forecasts. Now, that's not right. It's not exceeding my forecast. I've looked at their growth in their money supply. I think their inflation is really more like 7 or 8, but that would just be me. Matter of fact, I will look right
now. Who's doing what now?
India's inflation is up to 4.5% that they're admitting.
Do you think that it is, or do you think it's not?
It's a lot higher.
Oh, okay, that's what I think. Yeah.
I mean, while we're talking about something else, I will dig up India's M2.
Well, they're 4.5% makes no sense. If you look at the oil shocks they've had, okay, their cost of, I mean, that is insane. Just the cost, I mean, agriculture is so important for them. You know, they, above all people, have been hit by, and you and I talked about this once before, you know, it's agriculture everywhere now is petroleum based. So yeah, that makes no sense. My friends, that is certainly anecdotal. My two or three friends I talk to on a regular basis.
Well, April of 2025, M2 was 67.8K INR, whatever the hell that means. Anyway, 67.8 is the number. Now it's 79. So doing a quick math, what's 12 divided by 67? It's more than 10%, right? It's like 20%. So I'm going to say I'm going to say their inflation is way more than 4.5%. Just saying. So they got guys doing their Bureau of Labor Statistics like we have guys here.
Yeah.
Where's the, you know, I've listened to a couple of interesting.
Well, what do you think? What do you think? Oh, by the way, just it's 33 hours from here to Mexico City.
Yes, 33.
That's a ways. Now, does that include? That includes the time for shootouts?
No, we did not. AI did not calculate any gun battles on the way to or fro.
Can you bring
I actually thought Mexico City was slightly north of where it really is.
No, it's pretty central.
Yeah, it is.
You wonder. I mean, what are we, I was listening to several. One, I tried to review because I haven't read William Kennedy's book, Freedom from Fear, in a while, and there was a dude on there talking about what really caused the Great Depression. And they went through the whole routine that we've done on the show a few times, and I don't remember all five of the stuff, but obviously people, you know, if you're, you know, a narrow type of person, you say, okay, it was the crash of 29. Well, that was more of a symptom than a cause. It didn't help. But they went through the whole routine and how, after Versailles, things were so screwed up that the one part that the guy didn't say on the that I could have maybe added to it, because for a while I actually spent some time working on those crazy bonds and so forth that the Germans and stuff were selling over here during the 20s. But they basically said that the Germans had to pay all these reparations, which we've talked about, to France and Britain, and we demanded money from them for World War I debt. And then they said the U.S. was lending Germany the money to make it just this big, basically, circle bleep. But what they didn't say is Germany was selling bonds here to individual Americans that ended up being worthless. And they were they were supposedly gold-backed.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They were gold-backed bonds in companies that still exist, and the gold is supposedly deposited in banks that still exist. Yet, you can't demand payment from any of that stuff. The Supreme Court has said so, which I have no idea why. But they actually were sold here. They didn't have CUSIP numbers like you do now, everything you sell. But they were legitimate. They were sold in this country without breaking the law. I'll put it that way. So you had individual Americans buying bonds, going to Germany. Germany spending the money to France and Britain, and then Britain, and then sending the money here to our government. So it was basically a circular way of our government essentially draining money out of the people. Like, duh, like they still do, right? It was absolutely incredible. And then he talked about that, and then he talked about how crucial in that was foreign trade. Now, the only thing that kept it going was that trade was increasing every year. He said, then these two buffoons, Smoot-Hawley, decided to put this big tariff in, and Hoover, even though he thought it was a horrible idea, signed it anyway. And that just brought everything crashing down. Because now, with the trade dropping like a rock, then this whole thing they created, this whole circle bleep, basically fell apart. Sort of like a situation here when you have huge trade in this country to other places, the other places having a trade surplus to us, which they do, and when they bring the money back, they essentially buy government bonds. So if you have, a buffoon running the place, I'm not saying we do, if you have a buffoon running the place, if you put your finger in that trade piece and screw up the trade piece, how do you not think you're going to screw up the money coming back to us and the money we need to finance our place since we have our zillions of dollars in debt? So it's the same sort of thing. People worked against each other, and essentially which caused all this to happen. And you had a Fed. There was a Fed chairman who I guess was really, really smart, this guy named Strong. Have you ever heard those that name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, he croaks. Like, he was young. Relatively young, but he croaks. So now the Fed is leaderless, and they got three, a bunch of idiots working there, evidently. And their job really is to be a bank of last resort, which you never want to have to do, but that's sort of what they are supposed to do. Yet every day, John Lee, Jim Lawler's grandpapa walked up to a bank, and all of a sudden the doors hit him in the nose and broke their nose, and your savings is gone. And the Fed, instead of pouring money into these banks to say, no, at least give Grandpapa Lawler or Lee half their dough or a quarter of their dough, they did nothing. Which, if they would have done some sort of a FDIC in arrears and at least floated like half the dough or a quarter of the dough, instead, everybody lost all their savings in one day. You lose your job and your savings in one day. So all these things kind of piled on. And every one of them was really like a horrible decision coming from different directions. And we're doing some of the same stuff now. Right now, with our debt, you can't put a pin in the trade with the UK, in my opinion, if you owe UK $900 billion. I mean, what manner of idiot would do that? Yet we seem to have one. I mean, what am I wrong here? I mean, tell me, please. I hope I am. Nobody's going to say I'm wrong. I mean, I don't know what these guys are trying to do. I don't know what they were trying to do during the Depression I guess if you look at it, every bad decision was in a separate area, and they just must never have talked. I mean, the people demanding reparations from France and Britain should have talked to the people that said, well, you're going to do what? You're going to put a tariff on the trade? That's the only way those guys can pay us. What's the matter with you?
Well, that's it. I mean, that's pretty. It's very well documented that, the whole reparations were horrific, okay, and then we won't even talk about our the tariff issue, but I don't think that they, I think you're giving them way too much credit, and also, I'm going to get that money from them. I'm just going to get that money from them. And you know what? Screw everything else. I mean, there is that mentality.
John,
I mean,
they must have known that the Germans were selling bonds here to American citizens.
I don't think they. I mean, but that's somebody else. It doesn't matter to me, right? Oh, So Tom, that's just that's the other guy, okay? And who cares? Because people that are buying the bonds. Oh, they're probably German. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the self-interest is so high, And I don't see much difference now. I agree with you.
I buried in my emails from probably an old computer. I can show you pictures of these bands. They were very ornate. I'll say that for unbelievable. They were selling the stuff here. But the lack of talking back and forth. I don't quite get it. I mean, I don't see how this all kind of combines. You're supposed to have somebody who is the Victorian person in the, or not the Victorian, the, what do they call it, the Renaissance man in the middle of the room is supposed to be putting all this together, and I don't know that we necessarily do it. I mean, if you look at the Weimar Republic, the inflation, what they did, I don't know how they let it get out of control, but that was done on purpose. And a little of that's happening now. Now, what they did was say, okay, if we can't get France and Britain to, because we're gagging on these reparations, if we can't get them to lower the reparations, what are we going to do? We're gonna pile currency into the place, so the amount of currency, the $5,000 we owe them a month becomes worth nothing. Which, by the way, we're doing some of that now here, aren't we? We can't pay all these people back, so why don't we just pay them back with dollars that are worth half as much as they were when we got them? And if anybody thinks that's not happening, you know, I got a bridge for you. But so the people who actually did that, France and Britain actually came to the table and redid the documents. So they thought they were successful, even though their population, except for people who had long-term notes like farmers and so forth, or mortgages on buildings, were able to pay them all off. The regular people are just getting eviscerated. Yet they thought they were successful, and probably they owned a farm too. So this whole thing is a lot more complicated than you know. I think, even though everybody has a regular life and has regular stuff to do all day.
So where did you see that? Was this on YouTube or was this a?
It's the same thing I read in Freedom from Fear. I mean, if you really go back to the cause of the Depression, it's not. It was sort of the same as now. The rural economy, which was, this is another one that I forgot to mention, the rural economy had really been in a recession / depression for 10 years. And only 7% of the people owned stock. So the incredible roaring 20s of the stock market going up and people driving down Fifth Avenue and Duesenberg and those kinds of things was very narrow. Very narrow. I mean, the rest of the country was in deep doo-doo. So it's probably the only time, 1928-29, where the haves and the have-nots were actually separated more than they are now, and we're gaining on it now. So one of the other causes was a huge split in the health of the population, which is, I think, right where we're headed right now. Now that doesn't mean we're gonna have a depression or anything like that, but to not keep your eye on some of this stuff, I think if you're an economist or you own a big business or something, is probably kind of foolish. Or certainly if you're in government, which, you know, they have their own things they're worried about. How to get your pockets stuffed. And that's the one thing I'll say about Lindsey Graham dying. I don't appear, for at least from his bank account, now who the hell knows if he had, if his sons or other people made all the money. But I haven't heard that, so I don't think so. So I think on money, when the money matters, he was kind of like McCain. He was pretty straight, which is pretty good, in my opinion.
Absolutely, yeah. I did not disagree.
I mean, who knows? There might have been a brother-in-law someplace that got a bunch of dough, but it doesn't appear that way. I mean, I don't. There's no, at least over the weekend, there's nothing that says, gee, he got, you know, his wife's cousin, you know, 58 things from the government. I don't think he ever did, you know. So I mean, in that regard, those guys were pretty straight. He and McCain and the people like that. So I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing. Hey, we have Mr. Flanagan.
You do. Good morning, John. Yeah. Tom.
What have you? What have you? Now you're sitting there opining.
Morning, John. How you doing?
Good. You.
Good.
You're sitting there opining about all the stuff you disagree with. What don't you like? What I just said.
I was thinking about, you know, your talk on reparations and how that contributed or triggered the Depression, but also, World War II as well. And it made me think about other, you know, more contemporary, you know, movements toward reparations for whatever past sins you can accuse somebody of, and what they're really designed to do, and what they end up doing, it seems. Because, I mean, there was this isn't, I'm trying to think of history of these things, and, you know, like the Franco-Prussian War is 1870 with the, you know, the humiliation of the French. The Prussians, their idea of reparations was, we want the Prussian troops to march through Paris, and then we're going to leave. They're not going to occupy it. They took, you know, Alsace and Lorraine, you know, French provinces, which was the big, you know, reparations, I guess. It wasn't like they were obsessed with draining the French treasury or the French taxpayers. They got land. And that, of course, triggered, you know, the revenge movement.
I don't have much of a, maybe you guys, world travelers. Is that wine? What is that? It's real pretty good area agriculturally, but is it wine area? Is it grain?
It is wine. I've been there. Yeah, I've been there once. Several times, in an extremely rich area.
I mean, in terms of money, or in terms of
and, you know, you've got Strasbourg.
So it's
agriculture, but also coal
industry.
And,
okay,
I mean, it's very, very wealthy, and they've been fighting over it. You know, 1870, I think it was the 1870s that you had the Franco-Prussian War. That was just one of many times people have been fighting over that area. But very, you know, it's a very, very beautiful area too. I mean, you know, the Lion Hills, you know, very fertile plains. But yeah, they've been fighting over that for a couple thousand years. Well, 1,000 years at least.
Well, you only fight over the good stuff
during the Middle Ages.
You're not going to fight over a desert. I guess they do in the Middle East.
But you know, it didn't prostrate the French economy or French people. They bounced back, but there was always a sticking point with the loss of this, you know, traditional land that, you know, they had. You know, it was French speaking.
I've got friends from that area. They all have, and they have German names.
Yeah,
you know, from France. And the other thing, I mean, this is an aside. This other friend I knew that from that area, she told me so. Yeah, you know, she was my age, you know, she's, I don't know, 60 to 70 now. And she said that when she was growing up, half the older women wore black. They were all widows. So many people, because don't forget, I mean, World War II was fought over how many times? You know, once when the Germans came, and then when the Allies pushed them back. She said there were so many widows from World War II. And, you know, this is in the 70s. I mean, older women, obviously. She said, yeah, it's very common to see.
Well, there's how many widows were here from people who came back and all you did was smoke and all the other stuff when they were over there and then come back not so great of health. I have a question. Did Alsace-Lorraine area, did that go back to France after World War One?
Yeah. So, I mean, and if it ended there, it's, you know, this was never going to be an option for the French, because they were so steamed up and full of themselves after World War One. But if it had been, you know, we take this territory back and let it go, or much less draconian, you know, financial reparations or punishment, I don't know if it would have, you know, it might have postponed World War Two. I don't know if it would have, you know, foreclosed it as a possibility. It might not have resulted in a depression for Germany. Rampant inflation is serious, is what happened. So I think that the whole economic climate and military climate, you know, geopolitical climate might have been different had there been a different approach to reparations.
Hey, John, I completely agree. I would add, I mean, look, we're all, I think, kind of armchair historians here, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, because my interest is Asia, and I was actually writing some stuff down I wanted to talk about, but we'll do it at a later time. And the tariffs devastated, you know, some of the countries in Asia, because they were, you know, they were trading nations, and it really, you know, when you have that, and then it'll cause the recession. And I mean, it's not just the tariffs, but it certainly, if you're a trading nation, it does. And we were the gorilla in the on the block. It led to a lot of, you know, it led to, just like Germany, it led to a lot of unsavory people getting in power.
Well, what? So Jan, just quickly, the Maginot Line then included Alsace-Lorraine on the French side.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know what they decided to do with the one thing that's also not as obvious in the reparations part is, according to William Kennedy's book, when they got up from the table at Versailles, 95% of the then known oil reserves in the world were on the side of the Allies. There's no place could the Germans get oil. They didn't have any. So all the stuff like in the Middle East, all those areas that actually Jimmy knows more about than maybe the rest of us, because he toured that area, all that stuff ended up on the side of the French and the Brits.
I mean, true.
I mean, that whole area. And that's why, to a large extent, the reason why everybody's still fighting in the Middle East is because people from out of the area drew the borders, and they didn't. Let's just say they didn't do a 100-year job on the borders, did they?
No.
So your issues in Iraq are border issues. The issues with the French Foreign Legion leaving, that whole Algiers area, that whole mess. A lot of that goes back to all those times, right? I mean, it never seems to end.
I say bring back looting and pillaging. That was a way to settle victors go the spoils.
When did we get rid of it? We now just call it reparations, but...
When the Ottomans, you know, were... Go ahead, I'm sorry, John.
No, I mean, just looting and pillaging was what victors did. How do you think both the English, you know, National Museum and the Louvre got stocked? It's not like Italy or any of those places gave those paintings away. They were taken.
Well, actually, the World War II stuff, if you guys, one of the, a lot of books out there to the listeners, but one of the most amazing books I ever read was the Arm & Hammer by Arm & Hammer. I shouldn't say this, but I didn't read the back part, the last part, because, I mean, I knew we got control of Occidental Petroleum, but, you know, other than the stuff they did in Libya, but Arm & Hammer was a master at going in behind the scenes and essentially mopping up the fiasco. His brother and he, and they had a massive deal on Manhattan where they sold, you know, the Fabergé eggs that you see in the Bond movies?
Mm-hmm.
Those guys dealt in those things. They went into Russia and Germany after the war, mostly Russia. This is after World War One, and they ended up, people just wanted to sell that stuff because they needed money. So they would buy the stuff they're bringing here and sell it as, you know, massive art, which it was. And they had this huge business on all the art from Germany and Russia.
Arm & Hammer was one of the first. He was extremely adept at working with the Bolsheviks.
Yeah.
One of his first businesses was pencils. He did very well there.
You know what his first business was? His father was a doctor, and he actually has a medical degree, and his first thing he had to do was to go assist in a birth, and evidently the baby was a breech. So more than you need to know in the morning if you're eating breakfast. But if a baby is a breech and you don't have, you can't do a cesarean like you can now, you essentially got to reach in and try and find the baby's mouth, which is, jaw muscles are very strong, even in a baby. If you can open his mouth and get your finger in there, you can essentially pull the baby out. And that's what he had to do. And he goes, I'm never doing that again. And then his dad...
Jesus Christ, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And his dad was a doctor, and that's why whenever people talk about it, it just rankles me. When even people on the show, anybody who disagrees with our current economy is immediately branded a dirty socialist or dirty communist. Anybody who looks at our system now and says, this isn't exactly right. This isn't very competitive. This looks like crony capitalism to me. If you say that at all, you're immediately a socialist, which to me is horrific. But anyway, his dad was one of these people, and since we were in the, you know, basically the economy here was horrible, he went to one of these communist things. So they couldn't wait to catch the guy. And he ended up doing something on a berth, and they accused him of giving an abortion, which he never did, and sentenced him to jail. So while he was in jail, and young Armin decides, I'm not, I don't want to really be a doctor, or he actually did still want to be a doctor, but he went over to Russia just to see what it was like. And we talk about a period piece. He ended up, now when you get on the train, there's no lights on the train. You had to buy your own candle if you expected to be able to read at night or something. You had to bring all your own food. You had to buy it from station to station. And he's on there. He's trying to study Russian medicine. And somebody says, hey, I've got this stuff called asbestos. Why don't you come with me? Because where Armor Hammer made a lot of money is during the time when you couldn't drink,
Prohibition.
He produced something called tincture of ginger. Now, for those
tincture of ginger,
which essentially, I mean, ginger is obviously today people, you know, there's ginger pills and everything. Ginger is a health thing. Well, of course, they mixed it with alcohol, hence the name tincture of ginger. And he was shipping this stuff like there was no tomorrow. And every pharmacy that had a soda fountain, what they all did in those days, essentially became a speakeasy. Because if you added essentially sparkling water to the tincture of ginger, you had a highball. So the dude was making a fortune. And until finally somebody figured out, hey, this stuff is really alcohol. And they said, no, you can't sell that stuff anymore. So they shut him down. He said he was making, in months, he was making more than the movie stars in Hollywood. So that could shut down. And that's when he went to Russia. And you're right, he ended up making pencils in Russia, which, for those that don't know, making pencils is actually a very difficult thing to do. You need the wood, you need a drill that can do it, you need to be able to melt the graphite, put it in there. It's not a one-step process. And Russia had nobody that knew how to do it, so he found some place. He, for a period of like 7 or 8 years, his company made like every pencil made in Russia. And he got to meet all these people. And he said, the two smartest men he ever met in his life were Roosevelt and Lenin, which is interesting. He knew all those guys. And then when all this stuff happened, they were able to get a lot of that art and all those things. They had a huge thing going in Fabergé eggs. What was the name of that movie? Was it the one with Maude Adams? It wasn't Sean Connery, it was the other guy.
That's Octopussy.
Where were these Fabergé eggs? And these guys dealt in those things. How wild is that for a piece of history on a Monday morning? Then he ended up buying. The same thing happened. The same thing happened with Occidental Petroleum. Libya essentially kicked all the big oil companies out, right? And all this stuff was sitting there. And those guys, of course, didn't know how to operate the oil wells. So he went in and said, "Hey, guess what? I'll operate these wells for you." And that's how Occidental essentially started to become big.
Who was the person? Was it Armin Hammer that was the first guy? No, it was Getty that was in the Saudi Arabia.
It was Getty. No, Armin Hammer was not. I don't think he was there. He was Libya. That's where Axie. But they had been here. Then they were in California, I think. I mean, I don't know the whole history of them, but they were pretty big here. But their big thing was they went in, essentially mopped up after the big companies got kicked out of there, and then the mole man, I don't think could run it himself, or someone whoever was before him. Mr. Flanagan, this history, you know what I'm talking about. I think it's, what can you add?
Well, I was trying to like think of this as a heritage that we have now of all these terrible decisions. You know, World War One was fought stupidly and terribly, which angered everybody because the losses were so ridiculous. That amped up the hatred and the drive for reparations that were just ridiculous. And all it did was hasten.
I completely agree. I completely agree, John. Yeah. It's we don't understand right now the elite, in Britain and France and Germany, you know, the, because everybody was off marching off the war because it was, you know, it, you know, they were all imperial powers. So, you know, military service like this was, you know, was glamorized. I mean, somewhat like it is now here. But, I think everyone knows I'm a pretty, you know, patriotic, you know, my family's a military family. And, but they lost so much. And it also was the rise it caused. That's why communism took hold so intensely in England and in Europe in the, you know, right after World War II, because they just said, look at this bullshit that we all went through. You know, PTSD, my God, we don't even know what it is compared to what these guys came back to.
The people in Germany, when you think of this...
It wasn't a... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm saying, I mean, just the thought that ending in 1918, you had a country that lost 20 million people. They lost their entire, not entire, but a significant percentage of all the young males in the place. And 25 years later, they did it again. Another 25 yeah. million. I mean, yeah. how do you do that? Just in terms of numbers. I mean, we're not talking about China.
The Kaiser was Victoria's grandson. Yeah. I mean, you know, it doesn't get any. I mean, there are, you know, comments made that once she passed away, you know, he did have his. I mean, she was. There are letters I've seen. I've seen in books, of course. You know, basically, you know, giving him a little whooping. you know, what are you doing? Quit being a jackass. And Brit was very German focused, the royal family especially. And then all of a sudden, yeah, then you have this war that starts out of nowhere. To this day, people talk about, you know, how did we get here? How did this start?
Same thing that I just went through regarding the Depression. It was a bunch of dynasties that were becoming ridiculously corrupt. You had a massive arms race for whatever reason.
You had a massive arms race,
and you had a huge growth in population, and the economies of every place were kind of like falling apart. So everybody just figured they had to get it from the guy next to them. And you know, it was like what did William Kennedy say? Events were in the saddle, and they drove the men hard. I mean, nobody could. It has nothing to do with
the
Ferdinand.
Really,
yeah, yeah. Mr. Flanagan had nothing to do with the stupid count getting shot, was it?
Yeah, no, it had everything and nothing to do with it in a way. I mean, they just fought a war 2 years before the Archduke was assassinated. You know, the Balkans were a flashpoint on and off since Napoleon, but it was the trick.
Oh, yeah.
and it was used to, you know, for exactly what ended up happening as an ultimatum scenario. You know, you do this, you put up or shut up by this date, or we're coming in. And of course, then it within a weekend, all Western Europe was involved, and then Eastern Europe. And, the thing I find, you know, looking back on it. It was not a naval war in any sense. There was really only one naval engagement at Jutland, you know, in the North Sea,
yeah,
of
Jutland.
Any consequence. And yet it was things like the Lusitania and unrestricted submarine warfare that were the trigger points for, you know, the U.S. drum beats for war. And yet, what happened in the trenches, you know, a 3-year stalemate, pretty much, just ground up an entire generation of men. It's just, like, you know, you have to kind of shut out everything else to imagine how such a thing could possibly have happened in the last 120 years.
Well, it also, John, we don't want to go into military tactics. Plus, I want to bring it back a little bit to why we're talking about this is because the economics are still there. But the people that, I mean, another thing you can read about it is read John Marshall, soldier and state, George Marshall, soldier and statesman, because he served in World War I, and he couldn't believe the stupidity of the generals. I mean, you went to a point where, if you ever want to read how stupid they were, go back. If you ever out east, go to Gettysburg and realize the absolute stupidity of Pickett's charge, running men against guns firing at you when you really couldn't even fire back. Ratchet that up to doing the same thing with machine guns.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about stupidity on steroids. They used to run people against machine guns. I mean, for God's sake. I mean, Marshall couldn't, he goes, we studied these people in school. And we get over here, he goes, they were blithering idiots. When the Americans showed up, he goes, I wasn't in charge. Americans showed up, the French guys are, oh good, we have more people to run against the machine right. guns. And the Americans go, we're not doing that, you idiot. and the Americans never really did, even though obviously there were machine guns involved. But they outflanked people, they did stuff, they did different warfare. They just didn't, oh, we got another million men, let's run them at the machine guns like we've been doing for 3 years. I mean, why do people even do stuff like that?
Well, and you add to that...
Yeah, you know, it's...
You know,
go ahead.
Britain was bankrupt. I mean, J.P. Morgan, you know, bailed out the Brits before the U.S. even entered the war. I mean, it was one thing, the human toll and the civilian suffering and the devastation of industries and cities. You know, that's just like mind-blowing. But then, you know, the financial idiocy, too. But they couldn't even... They certainly couldn't afford from a human capital standpoint what they were doing, but they couldn't afford it from, you know, just a balance sheet.
Well, my aunt from Britain, her father had served in World War One, and somehow or another, I never got the full... I'm sure she didn't know the full medical history, but somewhere along the line, he got gassed. And I don't know what happened, why one lung was infected more than the other one. So they, can you imagine in 1917, them taking out a half a lung? Did they even have ether? I think they must have had ether. If not, good Lord.
Well, they had ether. They had morphine.
Well, okay. So still, the recovery period from that. And the dude lasted till he was like 75. I mean, it was a tough old bird. But she spent World War II. Any night there was a bombing, they lived in London, and they had a bomb shelter in the backyard. And she and her mother went out to the bomb shelter. It was only big enough for two people. And her brother and her father slept under the dining room table for like two or three years while this was going on. I mean, you know, people were getting blasted every night. And then, you know, you get these ambulances come by.
You know, it's really funny. World War II, I have some friends in London. We used to live there. And so one of our, turned out to be a good friend, is a tailor. And... fifth generation. Okay, so they've been there forever. He goes, yeah, well, we lost one tailor shop. It was downtown to the Blitz. And then the other one, we lost, we almost lost that one as well. He said, you could actually, we're living above the shop. And he said, this is from his father who passed away. And Philip is my age, or close to my age. He goes, yeah, well, you know, the war comes home pretty quick when you have your, when you can feel your house shake.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so what?
I mean, it's not funny, but.
But the economic lesson is based from, and I'm really, I don't know, you guys can debate it, but I think Mike Royko basically defined war as they got it, we want it, let's take it. I mean, all these other, you know, huge political reasons and so forth, basically stealing stuff from somebody, right? And that's what every kind of wants to do. And I'm of the opinion that there really wasn't a World War One and World War Two. It was just one war with a big break in the middle. But
that's what a lot of people say.
But
Chief, where this thing that was this on? You're talking about the four things that happened, because there's another one about I had the same thing from a political standpoint. Between the analogy between World War One before the World War One started and now, but what I mean, put it in the show notes or something, because I'd like to listen to it.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that we have to learn from then is we're making these economic decisions now that I think are very foolish, and they're also not very forward thinking. I mean, we seem to have an administration that is confused about trade balance versus current account balance, and if they screw that up, which I think they're doing, I think it gets you in a very bad spot. If you don't realize that you have a trade deficit with, say, Britain, and I'm not sure we do, but if we have a trade deficit with Britain and the Brits are using the money to buy our bonds, you at least have to realize that if you stop the trade, you're probably going to stop them buying our bonds, you would think. But I don't think our people are thinking this through, or they think somehow they'll cover it some other place. But just the idea, I would love to see, you know, I mean, you know, everybody's going to fact check me, but nobody fact checks the president. I don't think you could have a conversation with the man, and I don't think he understands this. I mean, if you look at, say there's an island, Jimmy owns an island that, you know, that makes God knows what, whatever you put in some drink here, and everybody decides they like it, some a cola nut or whatever they used to call it, and the uncola nut or something, and all of a sudden, we buy the thing. Okay, that island now has dollars, and we've got the uncola nuts. Okay, so we have this trade deficit. Does that mean they're screwing us? I don't think so. We're the ones who wanted to buy the stuff. Now, they're going to take that and say, well, maybe we'll buy, you know, a couple of Cadillacs from here, or maybe they'll go buy French wine because they don't have any wine. Okay, well, now the dollars are in France. Now, France may decide they want to buy something out of Britain. Okay, now the dollars are in Britain, and if Britain turns around and buys bonds here, I don't see anybody getting screwed there, or Britain buys Cadillacs from here. There's no obvious screwing of anybody here that I can see.
Yeah,
I mean, and yet we seem to have people in power that think so, and I don't know why they think so. I mean, I just don't know unless they're either just using it as a ruse to do something else.
I think it's a response to the corruption and you know anti-U.S. driving force of the WTO, which, you know, we kind of became a sucker punch victim for, and this is a way of stemming that or stanching it somehow. But certainly it isn't just, you know, it's beyond just trade deficit. There's all this, you know, revenge mentality against the U.S. in the WTO, where the U.S. I don't think has the U.S. ever won anything in the WTO.
We have the same kind of trade restrictions as other people. I'm not saying that we aren't getting screwed somewhere, John. I'm just saying
we are getting screwed.
Well, I mean, but you, some people listen to these people tell you we're getting screwed, but nobody ever explains it to you in a way that, yeah, I think there's a lot of places we are getting screwed. Okay, but there's probably a lot of places we're screwing other people. I mean, unless that's your livelihood, it's a question of who you believe. I mean, we talk about, you know, Canada having stuff on dairy products and how they're screwing us on this. But if you actually dig into it, and this is just a couple of ones, and I'm sure there's others that are worse, but they have, there's a two-stage tariff thing on that stuff for a certain amount of stuff that goes over the border from here to Canada. There's a duty of, say, X. Once it gets above that, it's like, you know, it's like two or three or four times X. And you could say, well, gee, they're screwing our farmers. Okay, but what they're really doing, and this is, I'm just explaining it, I'm not right or wrong, what they're really saying is we need a certain amount of dairy left in Canada just in case something ever happens with you guys, which is, by the way, happening, that we need to be able to have enough dairy here for our people. Okay, we're willing to import some, but we do the exact same thing with sugar, which probably nobody knows or nobody cares, and we're never going to hear from these guys. We do the same thing with sugar. There's a very small tariff on sugar. It's like 4 cents a pound or something. Once it goes over a certain number where we think it is a threat to our sugar farmers in Minnesota, where they do the sugar beets, and where's the other stuff? Where do we do the sugar canes? South somewhere? If it goes over a certain number, then it becomes then it becomes like 12 cents a pound. So we do the same thing. Same thing Japan does with rice. We need to have enough rice here. We need to protect it to the point where if something happens, we can still feed our people at some base level. So the first amount of rice to a certain amount we import, you know, here's the tariff is X. But oh, by the way, if it gets more than that, where our people are like folding up, it might be 10 times or 5 times the original amount. Every country does that. to a certain extent on things that they think are important to them. Same thing, I think we probably do the same thing with steel, but I'm not sure. I mean, we need some steel companies here if we want to build a ship, for God's sake. I mean, everybody understands that. So we're going to let some in, but we're not going to have let enough in to where our guys go out of business, although maybe we did in a few areas. So, I mean, the complexity of this is pretty dramatic. And you're right. I mean, Mr. Flanagan's right. At some places, we probably are getting the shaft, and other places, we're the ones with the shaft. Now, if you don't look at the whole picture of it, which I can't necessarily do, I'll tell you what, I did one time, foolishly, I dug up, you can go online and say, you know, yeah, you know, before AI, you go online and say, give me the tariff stuff. You guys, and the listeners would be stunned to see these tariff manuals. They're hundreds and thousands of pages. On one page, it'll be like a, somehow I opened it up to the cottage cheese page. Now, you wouldn't think there was a cottage cheese page, would you? It's less than 2% small curd, more than 2% large curd. I don't know. There had to be 50 different kinds of cottage cheese.
Look at the EU's regulations. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's 75. Chris used to do the show with us, said they had 75 pages in the EU regarding cabbage.
Yeah.
I didn't know there were 75 types of cabbage, but I guess there are.
You know, how much, whatever percentage you have to call it prosciutto di Parma as opposed to something else that nobody will buy.
I mean, it's, but so to listen to somebody on either side of the aisle come out with a five-word explanation and we're getting screwed or we're not getting screwed or we need to do this or these guys, it's like boiling down the human body into three words or something.
All right, gentlemen, I've got to get going here.
All right, bud. Take care.
All right. I'll talk to everyone later on this week.
Talking to you, John. Take care.
All right. So, talk to you later.
So, Mr. Flum, if maybe because I recognize it, I bet you do the same thing on the law side, John. Whenever somebody simplifies some economic thing in a way that makes it sound just what their policy is, I just shudder because that's the area that I know something about. You probably do the same thing if somebody lobs out a law. It makes the law so simple, and you go, wait a minute, that law's not that simple. What are you doing, right? I mean, it's amazing how people just blow over this stuff, but it's a very powerful political tool to give somebody just the story that they really want to hear. And I thought that in this day and age, you know, when Lincoln was around and you did a whistle stop tour and you went from city to city, I guess if you had a decent reporter with you, if you said one thing in Des Moines and another thing in Dubuque, they'd call you on it. But here, people still do it, even though we've got TV. And they still get away with it.
I was looking at a bunch of podcasts the last couple of weeks or so, and this name came up of one of Lincoln's financial advisors during, his wartime advisor, Henry Carey is the guy's name. You may know him.
You know what? I've heard the name, but I don't know what. Well, I guess at least. Well, whenever anybody says anything in the show, it leads to more questions. But go ahead.
But he's the son of another economist named Matthew Carey, who was born in Dublin, Catholic. Came from nothing, and he just happened to meet Benjamin Franklin in London one time when Franklin was overseas, I think right after the revolution. And Franklin really took a shine to this guy and was impressed by him, brought him back here. He settled in Philadelphia, produced a family, and he was a political, economic, maybe, just sort of self-taught. And he was, a real, opponent to Adam Smith and the Ricardo and the laissez-faire, stuff that was fashionable at the time. And his son, Henry Carey, was also an economist that was Lincoln's, advisor about paper currency and tariffs and everything else. And he was a tariff, a great tariff fan. And I just started poking around looking for some of his stuff. And I found one of his books from the 1850s online on the Internet Archive. And I just thought, I'll see how readable it is, because most of the stuff I find impenetrable. That's why I was an English major, because at least I could read those texts. I couldn't read, like, economists, theoretical, equations or whatever.
But this guy was one of the most readable people. I mean, he was a wonderful writer. And I just got hooked and wrote like 30 or 40 pages of this thing at the beginning. And it's nothing really but tables and comparisons between individual states and European countries and, you know, what their, you know, trade imbalances are and what their prospects are for flourishing and what they need to do if they don't want to go down this path. And I thought, just thought it was a brilliantly written anyway. But it's one of those things where, you know, I'd have to make a deeper dive and find out more what I'm dealing with. But it's kind of what you were saying about, you know, making the stuff intelligible to people and boiling it down and trying to you know, explain it or translate it in a way that the average person can make sense out of it. And I thought this guy really succeeded. And I have seen so little of that in anything that I try to learn from today, because it's all just drum beating and there's no way to like get any alternative viewpoints into the mixture. So you're just continually, you know, prodded and pumped to think one thing and nobody else gets a say in how this is being presented. But I just thought this would be kind of a model for how to write.
Well, Jack, I've done some history, and actually I've one right in front of me, written by a guy named John Steele Gordon, who wrote a terrific article on inflation in the United States. Was this guy, did he run our, I guess for lack of a better term, our money part of government during the war for Lincoln?
Yeah. He's, you know, I'd have to, you know, he pushed Salmon Chase, you know, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, and there was a big, you know, kind of a struggle in the Treasury Department at the time about whoever's theory was, you know, the best one, what the Confederacy was doing and what we had to do differently and all this stuff. But Carey, this Henry Carey and Salmon Chase were aligned, so they were on the same page with Lincoln, which is, I think, how they were able to stick around, because Lincoln trusted them, and it sounds like he took quite a bit of his, you know, reading of the situation from this Carey guy. And I'm just speaking as a total neophyte about this. I don't have any...
Well, first of all, you may think you're a neophyte, but you're not, because what you just said, I'm going to read a part of here that is actually spot on, and this is from this Gordon guy. And I've said a bunch of times, and of course, you know, I guess it's my fault because I just don't understand the deep thinking that Trump has. But this is not Trump. This is what we've been doing for the last, really, how many years? Really, since Nixon went off the gold standard, to be quite honest with you. But Jimmy, you appreciate this. Now, there's only three ways. If you're going to spend more than, you know, you got $1 million this year that you spend and you take in $1 million. Next year, for whatever reason, you're going to spend $1 million too. You better find a way to come up with the $200,000. There's three ways to do it. You tax people, you borrow it, or you print it. And here is the, I'll go back to the Civil War. The government here, the Union side, was able, most of the cost of the war onto the future, meaning that they borrowed it. In 1860, the national debt stood at $64 million. By 1966, it was at $2.7 billion. And about 5% of the North's population had invested in federal bonds. So the North was able to raise two-thirds of its revenues by borrowing. Okay? Now, that's number one. You borrow it, correct? The Confederacy, with far less liquid capital, much smaller middle class, and few large banks, could raise only about 40% of its revenues for bond sales. So one is 66 and the other is 40. It was the same with taxes. The federal government sharply raised tariffs, its main source of income before the war, and excise taxes. It also taxed gross receipts and imposed a stamp tax on legal documents for you lawyer guys. the country's first income tax, by the way, was passed was passed in 1862. So altogether, the North raised 21% of its revenues through taxation. So we're up to 87% of the cost for the war being done through taxes and borrowing. The Confederacy, with less developed and cash poor economy, was able to raise only about 6% of its revenues through taxation. Thus, the federal government needed to use the third means of raising revenue, printing fiat money, for only about 12% of its revenue needs. So even in the Civil War, we only had to raise the money supply by 12% a year, which is what we're doing now, for God's sake, and what we did during COVID. And I don't think we're anywhere near the problems we were in the Civil War, do you? I mean, So the federal government needed to use the third means of raising money, printing money, for only about 12% of its revenue needs. In the course of the war, the Treasury printed $450 million in greenbacks. This caused inflation, as fiat money always does. Oh, no, now it doesn't. Our Federal Reserve doesn't think so. This guy, like he says here, as it always does. I mean, why are we listening to these buffoons? I mean, and we're not talking about this guy's buffoons. We're talking about Biden's buffoons, his buffoons, Obama's buffoons, everybody. Altogether, it says all the South, together the South printed $1.5 billion. The prices rose over the course of the war in the North by a manageable 75%. So over 4 years, we're up 75% on prices. The South had to fully meet 50% of its revenue needs by printing money. And we're borrowing more, but we're not taxing anymore. So we're trying to, what are we doing? What percentage are we doing here by printing money? State and city governments also printed money, which is cool. But because the South lacked good paper mills and state-of-the-art printing facilities, counterfeiting flourished. Altogether, the South printed about $1.5 billion in fiat money, three times as much as the North, despite only having 12% of the circulating currency before the war and 20% of the banking assets. The result was catastrophic inflation. Prices rose 700% in the South in the first 2 years of the war. So, I mean, we can have a bunch of buffoons telling us that it doesn't matter putting money into the system. It's happened in this country so many times. All you gotta do is read it, John.
Yeah. Well, what it did for the long-term prospects of the South too after the war, and the North was booming, and the South was behind it well into the 20th century, I think, just in industrialization and development. And you extend that into things like electrification and transportation, whatever. The South it paid a huge price for that, for just in their financial future. Unbelievable.
Why are we so anxious to throw this away? And I actually, I think Lindsey Graham was one of the few people that kind of understood this. I mean, he was on the side of the aisle. I mean, he's more of a McCain kind of, if it's a problem, we gotta shove our forces forward.
Yeah, we have to fight our way out of it.
But you know what? I don't really mind that point of view as long as we can talk to each other. And it seems to me that most people said he was a guy you could talk to. So I don't really mind the opposite point of view unless people just shut you out.
Well, you can see it, just to talk about Graham, in the hearings, for example, when Feinstein was still in, at least attending meetings for the Judiciary Committee.
Give us a little history of that guy, of Feinstein. What was the story with that, Jen? She's from California, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's just kind of a very unlikely rise to power, because she was a relatively obscure council person in San Francisco city government, and after the assassination of the mayor Moscone in 1978, I think that was, and Harvey Milk, the ridiculous attack by Kevin White, who was a disgruntled job seeker, or trying to hang out to his job. So the mayor was assassinated, and she became the kind of coalition figure that became DiFi, the darling of the left, mayor of San Francisco, and then parlayed that into a Senate seat. Not what the kind of rise to power that you traditionally saw, but it arose out of a very horrible situation in the city of San Francisco, and she was a conciliatory figure to kind of calm everything down. There was the whole Jim Jones involvement, Guyana later on. I mean, the forces of San Francisco were all tied up with that nut stuff down in Guyana too. But she kind of weathered the storm and became powerful figure for the left. And yet she and Lindsey Graham were always, showed the utmost courtesy and regard for each other.
Well, what else, Jan, is I think, obviously, I think they've come from different ends of the earth, but in terms of politically, but both of them had to be pretty damn smart, because both sides felt comfortable with them on these double secret covert operations committees and stuff that not everybody gets appointed to. I mean, even the people there look around and say, those two people should be on there and not me. Because both of them, they were both on these really secret committees, and I think even if they had different political views, I have a feeling they had some, you know, they were able to talk to each other. Because what is that? What is the... what are the two committees I'm talking about? We're not talking about Armed Services Appropriations.
No, they were the Judiciary Committee. Right?
Yeah, but also, she was on forever on the one where...
Well, she's on the Intelligence Committee.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The people are on that committee, they don't just get there by chance.
No.
I mean, that's why I think, Mike...
But also, she was also the one who had the driver on her staff who was a Chinese spy for years. And nobody was aware of it, or if they were aware of it, they decided not to talk about it or bring it up. And so that was a huge embarrassment for her, that she has...
Speaking of which, what is the deal, and boy, oh boy, what is the deal with this Elena Chao running over, going over and then meeting with the premier of China while the guy's in the hospital? What is that all about?
Don't ask me, Tom. I mean, I have theories about it, but they're totally baseless in any kind of evidence you can, point to. But, I mean, all you have to do is read some of Peter Schweitzer's books, Blood Money, about China and its, influence in this country. And the stuff about Elaine Chao is kind of horrifying, that anybody like this would be allowed in the country, let alone be married to a powerful U.S. senator.
And have two cabinet positions.
Yeah, and two cabinet positions. I find it jaw-dropping that this...
Well, she was on the board of Wells Fargo.
Everybody run from.
She was on the board of Wells Fargo?
Yeah.
Well, just as the way people... And I'm not going to take a liberal shot. I'm just going to point something that... when Dennis Rodman, of all people... I seem to recall him going to... Didn't he go to North Korea or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And meet with... Goofball, what's his name?
It was like some kind of shuttle diplomacy to kind of defuse all these tensions.
And everybody, white conservative, and maybe other people, said, there's a law against that. Private citizens meeting with foreign leaders and trying to influence stuff. And a whole bunch of people said that about Jesse Jackson when he tried to broker a peace in the Middle East back in the day. How come the same people aren't saying we should jail her for going and meeting with the head of China? Well, I was going to say because she's white, but she's not.
Question.
I mean, what? I mean, I don't know. I don't the law to jail people. I mean, I'm not so sure. But whether you should or shouldn't is not my call. I'm not smart
enough.
Right.
I mean, she's a private citizen like you and I.
Yeah.
And yet, she's not a private citizen in any kind of sense of that. Phrase, given her connections, and God knows what those connections are and how they've been strengthened and influenced, and how God knows what it means in the bigger picture. But yeah, it's a good question. Why is that?
People were ready to string Jesse Jackson up and Rodman up. Yeah.
I don't think it would even be known, Tom, except the Chinese released a photo of her sitting there with the vice president of China.
Well, her husband's
I don't remember anything being...
Didn't they used to call that a marriage of convenience in the Middle Ages when the queen would send the son over to marry the person in the other country?
Betrothed them at age six. And, at least we got some dynasty, control here. We're not going to fight for this territory. We're going to agree to hold on to it together.
Well, she was on the board of, was she the head of governance? The Wells Fargo board when they got all those fines?
It was a big job. It was a big job.
Well, she was definitely on the board. None of those people... When are we going to find, our buddy Carl is, he loves doing this, but he's not wrong. I mean, when are we going to take, we got Mike Madigan in jail for allegedly, getting payoffs from Commonwealth Edison. Why don't we at least take the entire board of Commonwealth Edison and say you can't be on a corporate board? I'm not saying
I'll put him in jail. I'll trade you Madigan for the entire Commonwealth Edison board.
Yeah, I'm not going to behead him or flog him in the county stair. I mean, but why are they still on the board? That's their job, is to make sure this kind of crap doesn't happen, right?
Well, it shows there's this kind of this displacement theory about who the guilty parties really were here. And I don't think there's much benefit from jailing somebody like Madigan any more than there probably would be for jailing, you know, Anthony Fauci, although I think he deserves a long jail term. I wish they'd started it about 20 years ago. But this isn't getting at any of the real problem here.
The whole idea is that this happened, this thing at Wells Fargo happened under her watch. Now, I was on a board a long time ago, and it was a pretty good board. It was a board of a finance company, but it was CBOE. But it was a board nonetheless. And I was very privy to how stuff like this could happen, where some people you went after and some people you didn't. It was really hard to go after somebody who's sitting next to you on the board, right? Everybody has to get along. We're all board members. We're the upper, you know, a high-end cloth. And, I found that out a couple times when I felt like I was the dumb Southsider. Actually, I wasn't the dumb one, but I could see where... When we hired the new chairman when I was there, Jen, and of course they get this compensation guy come in and start telling you about what you got to give the new guy. And it was like, first we're going to give him all this money. Oh, by the way, the thing now is you don't get two club memberships, you get three. And I'm going, right away the hair is going up in the back of my neck. And you get this kind of stuff for your retirement. And then finally they got to the one where they go, well, because like we're giving them all this, we got to give them another 10 grand. This is 1998. We got to give them another 10 grand so somebody will do his taxes for him. And finally I go, wait a minute. We're going to give this guy so much dough that we got to give another 10 grand just to do his taxes? I don't know if I could go. Well, the look of all these people looking at me like, I can't believe we got this shoeshine guy in this room that he's worried about 10 grand for our new boy. And I'm sitting there going, I thought it was disgusting, John, but let's put it this way, I was the only one who felt that way. Just me, you know. But I mean, what are we doing? We're looking at corporate boards. That's why I want my strong, if I could do one policy thing, I would change the tax law so that corporations paid as much as everybody else, but they got to deduct dividends. I don't want Elon Musk making $1 trillion a year. I want him to pay dividends that people own the damn place. Now, he owns a lot of it, so he'll get part of the dividends. I get that, but that's okay to me. If all of a sudden these places paid three times as much dividends they do now, I think we would help all the people who have the 401ks, the IRAs, certainly help my clients, and not all of them are doing great because, you know, God help them if they put a roof on the last year and are 80 grand out of pocket. I mean, I think we need to make some changes here, and one of them is that these corporate boards, their job is to control the president. I don't think that happens at all, do you?
It's the other way around.
It's the other way around. Right, so what exactly? I mean, what is the story of the modern corporation? Are they the foe or are they the friend? I don't know. I mean, a lot of the stuff we talk about, and you know, I know people. You talk about the immigration, getting these people out of the country, and somebody will actually say something I think incredibly ignorant, like to the point where, okay, how do we know if a person is? He's got a green card for 25 years. Their heart really isn't still in Poland or Germany or Jamaica or someplace. Okay, well, what about the chairman of, like, NVIDIA? What if he has five houses around the world? Do we think his heart's really here? I mean when we start opining on where people's hearts really are, how are we qualified to do that exactly?
Well, I can just kind of listen to what they say. It's pretty hard to... pretty easy to see that a lot of these people, their heart was never here.
Yeah.
And it was any place else but here.
Well, I mean, the Harold Janine, the head of ITT, the first multinational, these governments are just in my way, businesses really should be running the world. That was his attitude, and I don't think it's changed, have you?
No. Hey, well, it's been kind of codified, really.
That's the way it ought to be. And the idea that you let them build these mass amounts of money instead of giving it out to the shareholders, that's not the way corporations are supposed to be. I mean, I think somehow, I use the term influenced, I don't want to say brainwashed, although I just did. Why is it that if you and I and Jimmy, and we'll take Matt Byrne with us, and we see a guy wants to open up a hot dog stand, and we go, okay, we'll buy, we'll give you half the dough for the hot dog stand. By the way, you get the salary, and we'll have a board, and we'll have to do what we're supposed to do. And at the end of the year, a hot dog stand makes, let's say it's a great hot dog stand, we make $1 million. okay, now we're going to have a, we're going to say next year we're doing so good, should we invest that money in like another hot dog stand? Well, yeah, maybe we should, maybe we didn't. But it's a collective decision. Somebody makes the decision, the board approves it or doesn't approve it. And then we decide, okay, well, with this $1 million, we're going to distribute, you know, if we really have investment opportunities the next year, we might say, well, you know what, next year we won't distribute any of it because we got a way to, we think this $1 million, if we spend it, next year we're going to do really well with that. That's a decision. Okay, now the next year, maybe we make the $1 million and we're doing better next. Somewhere along the line, we're going to get to a spot where they're going to say, well, we just made $4 million, but really, we only have investment opportunities that we can really know for sure we're going to make money on for $3 million of it. Well, what do you do with the other $1 million? Well, you distribute it to the shareholders, right? That's what's called a dividend. Now, but what if if the chairman boots all of us, who maybe even gave him the money in the first place, the chairman boots us all off the board, and now his guys, and the answer is, we're never giving you guys any money. I'm keeping it all, and I don't care. Next year, I might want to buy a steel company. Well, wait a minute. You don't know anything about steel. Yeah, but I want to be big. I want to be a big shot. And all of a sudden, you're buying this, you're buying that, and the board has no and you never pay a dividend, even though that was kind of the promise to the people who gave you the money in the first place. I mean, there has to be some, everybody has to work, has to have somebody in charge of them, right? I mean, even the president has the voters in charge of them to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only control there is on that kind of, you know, unfair treatment of stockholders is general outrage, but I don't even think that's enough. It's outrageous enough, but it doesn't. There's no control that I can see that's going to make anybody change that.
And if somebody else runs for the board, the SEC is your biggest, opponent. They don't want people doing that.
Right.
Then you have mutual fund companies that, if they vote at all, will. Matter of fact, the charters used to be that if somebody didn't send his vote in, it voted for what the board wanted. How scary is that? Well, what do you say? We have Nance. So we'll talk a little bit about the mortgages and these rates going up. Can't be good for the mortgages. Rates are up again today. I've got the 10-year, which we'll talk about in a second, is up to almost 4.6, and we've got the 30-year at 5.1. This is a problem for both mortgages and whatever. The taxation's a problem. We've got issues. And we talked to Kevin on Friday a lot about a lot of the work they're doing at Ivy Tech, trying to get people from the, $20 an hour range up to the $35-$40. It's incredible work, John, but when we get Nance on here, where does that even get you? I mean, obviously it's better than 20, duh, but where does that put you? Anyway, S&P futures down 31, NASDAQ futures down on 350. You've been leaking the whole time we've been on. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. Time out. Matt Byrne on the board. S&P futures down 33. NASDAQ futures down 365. Kind of ouch on that. We have over in Asia. Last night it was... Nikkei is down 1,300. That's almost 2%. Hang Seng, however, is up 38. That's 0.1%. Shanghai down 82. It's 2%. I wish John Lee was still here as to why the last several weeks we seem to have Hang Seng and the mainland going in different directions on a lot of days. I don't know why that's happening. I'm not a China expert. DAX up 19. Call that flat. FTSE down 19. That's 0.2%. CAC around up 1. Call that flat. So they don't seem to be having a problem that we are here this morning. As a way of review, Friday, S&P was up 31, which is almost exactly what we're down today. NASDAQ, however, was only up 74, and now we're 362. So S&P is just giving back what it made on Friday. NASDAQ a little bit worse than that. Bonds, this is the issue. We're up 2 basis points again in the 10-year, 4.58. 30-year is 5.09 now, so we're almost pushing 5.1. Japan 2.79, which is high as they've been like a real long time. Oil up 265. We're back up to 74.06, which, you know, it's nowhere near the 90 when this all started, but it's a long way from the 67 a couple weeks ago, so it's creeping back up here. RBOB is up 8 cents, 306. I was well over $4 again this week when I got some gas. So, like I said, you got to add whatever your taxation is to your state. Here it's roughly a buck, Chuck, so you're over four here, and that's assuming that the guy doesn't make any money and there's no transportation costs, but guess what, there are. Gold down $45, almost didn't make it his 4,000 number it rallied off of before, 4,068. Silver down $1.38, 58.78. Foreign exchange, dollar is, you know, about the same, 1.14 to the euro, 1.33, maybe down a little bit. The yen, however, is down again, 162.15. Those guys are, you know, kind of in panic mode over there. Crypto down 1,500, 62,661. Still up from when Trump said he loves crypto, but off the top. Matt, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. It's July 13th, currently 7:34 a.m. Weather real quick, 79 degrees currently. Plenty of sunshine today with a high of 90. Tonight, low of 77 and clear skies. Over to sports, yesterday for the Chicago's MLB teams, Cubs won against Cincinnati Reds 8-4. White Sox won against Oakland Athletics 9-1. White Sox are 50 wins to 45 losses this season. Cubs are 54-42. Both teams are off this week, but we'll see Cubs outfielder Pete Crow Armstrong play for the National League in the All-Star MLB game on Tuesday. Playing for the American League from the White Sox are infielders Miguel Vargas, Munetaka Murakami, and outfielder Tristan Peters. Over to FIFA semifinals, France plays Spain on Tuesday and Argentina plays England on Wednesday. So I got you.
Thank you. 2 o'clock. You got to get there bar early, man.
Yeah, I was there. I was at an Irish pub for England versus Norway.
How'd that go? Been a good time.
I'm surprised so many English supporters in an Irish pub, but they were going crazy for that game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's they almost won.
Yeah. It was close. Close one.
It was close. Do we have Nancy?
We do, yeah.
Hey, Nance, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Morning, Nancy.
Good morning, John. How are you today?
I'm good. You?
Pretty good. Can't complain.
We had a nice... Get a load of this, guys. Talk about... I felt like it was the five easy pieces, right, yesterday. Well, Audrey's got these guys over working at her place, my guys. And so I, of course, go get lunch, right? So the kid likes health, but then he decides he wants... do they have any Domino's pizza? And I go, God, I haven't been to a Domino's pizza ever. With all these good pizza places. Anyway, the place we go, you know what I'm talking about. I won't name it. It's really good hot dogs, really good sandwich, really good stuff. The guy's done really well. He's got like three locations now. And plus, he's got a kind of a pizza gelato place there. So I'll tell you what. I'll get you your normal chicken sandwich, and I'll get us a couple pieces of pizza. Which doesn't sound too difficult, does it? So, of course, I order up the chicken sandwiches for those guys. And I say, hold on, I got to walk next door and get the pizza thing. So I go next door, and there's this lady, got these big pizzas out there, selling it by the slice. And I say, okay, how about why don't you give me a pepperoni and a sausage? Okay. You mean a quarter pizza? I said, no, I mean a slice. No, we only sell it by two slices. Okay, well, how about giving me a pepperoni and a sausage? Oh, no, you can't mix and match. I said, all right, why don't you give me whatever you got to give me on the pepperoni side and whatever you got to give me on the sausage side. Okay. And she says, well, you know, you get two drinks with that. Okay, well, give me a couple Diet 7-Ups. That's what those guys like. So they pull out. She pulls out these cartons, and neither one of them fits in the carton. And I go, let me get this straight. You can't buy one piece. The two pieces don't fit in the thing you got to carry them out in. Yeah. And I said, well, who's in charge of it? She goes, not me. And then the whole thing, a half a pizza and two quarters and the two Diet 7-Ups is only like $10. Okay, then. I mean, it was like the five easy pieces. What's the last thing? Hold a chicken salad or something?
Yeah, you should hold it between your legs.
Yeah. What was that? It wouldn't give him rye toast unless he got a chicken salad sandwich with rye toast. Right. Then he said, hold everything else except for the toast.
And he just clears the table.
Yeah.
With last gesture.
Anyway, Nance, I want to hit you with some math at this hour because I was thinking about you as Kevin was going through the... And I, by the way, I can't congratulate him or his place more, but the administration has come out with Pell Grants for essentially, I don't know, John, how would you describe it? It's not for blue collar, it's for training other than going to college. So if you want to become an auto mechanic or a welder or something, you can apply for it, which I think is a spectacular idea. And Kevin's school, Ivy Tech, seems to be really good at this. They jump right at it. So, of course, now they're, you know, people can go there and get, and, you know, and Kevin's focus for a long time, even though they, you know, they do all kinds of stuff. They have the first 2 years of regular college there, too. They try and, you know, Kevin's deal always has been if somebody who is making, you know, $15 an hour in a warehouse, we'll get him the training to get him to 20, and then we'll get him the training to get him to 25 and 30 and 35. And by the way, it's spectacular work, and they do a good job, it appears, seem to be seemingly better for some reason than the Illinois schools. My question is, I go through the economics of this, Nance, it's terrific, but it's so far behind in terms of what the inflation and stuff really is. I mean, so my question to you is, so say, and again, I'm going to be very old here, that whatever somebody makes an hour, I multiply by 2,000. There's actually 2,080 hours in the year with the way it used to be. I don't know that people get the 2,000 hours anymore, but let's forget that for a second. So let's say Kevin has a guy or a lady, Kevin, the school, and he's part of it, has somebody who's making $15-$18 an hour, and all of a sudden with some of the supply chain stuff, some of the distribution stuff, that person is now worth enough to the firm where they're making $35 an hour or 40. Let's say 35. Well, first of all, good job to them. Good job to Ivy Tech. Good job to Kevin. But now the person is making $70,000. The median price of a home is $406,000. I think, to be gross, they're still pissing up a rope. If somebody walks into you, Nancy says, I'm making $80,000 a year and I get $5,000 in the bank, what can you do for them? Anything?
I could try. I mean,
well, you're always going to try. You're Nance, for God's sake.
Yeah, it's I guess there's going to be something out there for them,
but not at 406.
No.
I'm saying that's the median price. So the average person, this person isn't even average anymore. He's making $80,000. He's way above average. How far away is he from the median house is what I'm trying to get at.
I don't know. It depends if he has any other debt.
I'm saying he has none. He just, $5,000 in the bank and he's making $80,000. Can he get in a $400,000 house?
So I'm figuring it right now. He can, as long as he doesn't exceed $3,000 a month.
Well, what's the mortgage tax?
Let's go over to the calculator over here. And then I can answer your question. So let's just say he had the 20% to put down. Okay, let's just say. So he had.
So somebody gave him 80 grand. Okay, that's a start. Who would that be? Flanagan? Give the guy the 80 G?
Right.
Just pull it, pull it out of the bottom, underneath the socks. You pull out 80 grand. And
he probably could. He probably could because his payment would be around 2,000. Figure the house insurance might be, well, he'd have to get lesser insurance and then the tax bill. You know, possibly. Possibly if he had no other debt, possibly.
All right, so if he's above, he's well above the median wage, and only if somebody gave him 80 grand could he get in the median house. Maybe.
No, I guess you could say that, but it's, you know, let's hope they do have some money. Let's hope they have the money saved, okay? But there are lesser homes out there. I mean, Audrey and I did an open house yesterday. It was $329. Now, that he could afford.
Was that a house or a condo?
Townhouse.
Okay.
Townhouse. But still, I mean, it was... I thought we would get, and, you know, I believe Audrey thought we could get younger people in there. I thought we would get older people in there because it was a ranch townhome. And they are extremely hard to find. And it had a full basement with a full bath down there.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought that you would get more younger people because then you could have had the kids in the, you know, playing in the basement. Very cozy. Very nice. And we got a ton of people who are downsizing and ready to retire. So, and that makes sense as well, right? People, I can't tell you how many people came in yesterday and said, I don't do stairs anymore. And I can understand that. And like I said, well, even if you know, your grandkids came, you could put a, you know, the chairlift in from the basement.
Oh, God. Shoot me first.
It's not bad. It's really not bad, Tom. I put one in for my parents in their townhouse. It was a ranch, and they had a full walkout basement. And to be honest, I sent a lot of stuff up on the chair to them. Like, would bring in extra paper towels, you know, just so that we wouldn't have to run out in the middle of winter when they forgot they needed something. And we had a whole nother kitchen down there, so it was, you know, if they really wanted something, I mean, you could have two different people living on two different floors. It's really a great idea, especially if you had a caregiver. The caregiver has their own bathroom, their own shower, their own kitchen. And a lot of times we send stuff up on the stairs. I've sent the dog up on the stairs once.
Oh, good.
My dad was waiting at the top like, oh, okay, he's here, because he wouldn't come up the stairs. So I put him in the chair and strapped him in and said, okay, you're going up.
Oh, that's great.
Grandpa wants to see you. So, it's not a bad thing at all. If you put it in, you should use it, I think. I mean, but, and when they wound up having to go to the assisted living, I mean, you wouldn't believe how much stuff I got out of the basement by using the chair.
Well, so I'm not, what I'm saying is it would be time, I think, to get a ranch. And not that I wouldn't use one of those things. I mean, obviously everybody does, but I mean, it's time to. By the way, were you not to cast any aspersions to my significant other? Were you on the receiving end of the picture of the poor dog that is looking for a home? It can't, is deaf. I don't know why she sent me that picture.
Yes, I saw that.
I kind of wish I wouldn't have got that. Let's send it to Flanagan.
Well. Tell you what, I mean, there was a lady there from the Humane Society yesterday, so, and they actually, and I found this interesting, they actually help people who have dogs, they can no longer afford them, they will give them the veterinary services, and they will give them food for the dog, because they'd rather keep the dog in a loving home than just, you know, have to reposition them, rehome them, maybe is the right word. So I thought that was very cool myself, that they actually have service. We actually have services like that out there. But, I mean, that's not this dog's story, but that's besides the point. But I don't know why anybody wouldn't want to take the dog. I heard he's well-behaved and everything else. The owner just doesn't.
So my first question to Odd was, is he totally deaf or just selective hearing like Scruff and Maggie? My old dog, he only listened when he wanted to. I couldn't tell if he was deaf or not. Anyway, you know, this is Jen. You're half psychologist. See how difficult it is to ask anybody in Stocks and Jacks a simple question.
About the dog?
No, about there's no question that if anybody could get somebody on the edge into a place they like, it would be Nancy. But the question is actually much simpler than that. If somebody has to break their neck to get to a spot to where they're making $40 an hour, which I think is reasonably high, and they have to go to school and all the other stuff to get there, which, by the way, I congratulate them and the school, they're still, according to AI here, they've got the individual median annual personal earnings are around $47,000. Now, the guys at Net Debt Clock got it. The danger I see is if somebody, the person making 80, whatever median income you get, is significantly higher due to their own work and help from schools and whatever, is significantly higher than the median. And yet in today's incredible inflation world, it's still nowhere near enough. I mean, that's kind of the message. And I think, Nancy, you would agree that if you somehow got this person in the place, which if anybody could do it, you could, and all of a sudden the air conditioner conked and the roof started leaking, they're in deep doo-doo.
Okay, but I honestly, truthfully, Tom, I wouldn't put them in a place where I thought there was more trouble than they could handle, because you want the person to succeed.
I know.
So there are places, I mean, you're describing a situation that is true.
Well, I'm talking median to median. There's no question that the guy can go buy a house in rural Mississippi and live happily ever after, but yeah, that's not where he is.
It's really hard, though, because even though that's the average median, you got to remember they're going off two-income people.
All right.
You know, so that's tough, especially if you're making eight, if both spouses are making 80, well, then, and that turns them into 160, then they can really afford this average median. You know what I mean? So when you look at the average median, you have to say to yourself, is that for one or two?
Okay, I get, no, this is the median for... Yeah. The median
I
for
know. The average median is 380 for a home right now. Period.
Well, the median for the median for households is 88,000, age 25 to 44.
That's true. It's a true statistic.
45 to 54 is 92. Now, mm-hmm. the other part, if we want to dig into it, and I don't know the answer to this. If two people are working and you have two kids, how much do you have to shave off the second person? I'm not going to say the wife's income. How much you have to shave off the second worker's income for their expenses are now higher, maybe need two cars, need more clothes because nobody dresses anymore. And oh, by the way, what about child care?
Okay, that doesn't get figured into the car gets figured in, but nothing else you said gets figured in.
All right, so if person's making $40 an hour and you're paying $20 an hour in child care, seems to me like you're netting 20.
It doesn't get figured in. I mean, I sit people down and say, what's the reality of what you have left at the end of the month? But a lot of people don't. Yeah. I mean, you do not have to by law. So if they want to do it, they can. But like I tell people, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. Not crazy.
When I was chairman of the marketing committee at the SIBO for a couple of years, we had a great staff, just a great group. And, two or three ladies worked there, and you know, we became good friends, and knew their husbands, you know, nice people. I mean, absolutely salt of the earth. And one of them, Reva, says to me one day, you know, I'm barely breaking even. I go, what do you mean? She goes, well, we got two kids, and this is, you know, it's 90, so she's making 70, 65, which is
good money back then.
It's good money, and very bright, and she goes, I love what I'm doing. But she also had to travel for the CBOE, so she's gone 5-6 days a month easy. So sometimes, you know, but between the clothes I have to wear, because back there, you know, be dressed up, even not just work, but certainly on the road, I got to have a car to the train, I got a monthly train ticket, and by the way, we've got people that are here every day, and if I'm out of town, you know, they stay at night. She mm-hmm. goes, I'm netting maybe 15, but I love it. And my husband says it's okay. He doesn't want me, you know, if that's what I want to do, that's what we do. We have a great marriage, and the kids are everybody. She goes, but to think I'm walking home with 75 grand is crazy. I'm not.
Well, that's true. I mean, that is the dilemma I think we're all facing.
And, you know, I just, we can't, we got to stop lying about these numbers. I mean, it's, I mean, I don't know why we are. I mean, I know why we are. I mean, I absolutely know why we are, but.
Why are we?
Well, because the government, if they say the inflation is 8%, they got to give everybody an 8% Social Security bump. Get everybody on disability for the vets, they got to give them a bump. And oh, by the way, people don't want to hear it. Some people actually believe, they see from their own eyeballs the inflation's 6, and whoever's president, if they like the guy and he says it's 2, they believe him. And why people are like that? I never believed anybody. But that's me. I don't think you guys are believers either.
No, it's. I mean, I already know it's all nonsensical, but that's why I tell people you really have to sit down and figure it for your. I mean, we have to have a conversation of what is on paper, and then what is the reality of all this. So, what do you want to do?
What do you make of the raise in for the Bodias? What do you think about this creep now? For three times now, three or four. The 10-year is going to 4.5 and bounce right back. 30-year is going to 5 and bounce right back. This last week, they've gone to those numbers, and they kept going like dinner through a goose here with no signs of coming back the other way. What does that do for the commercial side, Jen? What does that do for the... I mean, I'm not talking about there's a 4.55 and 4.58, but what if we're looking at 5.5 or 6 and 6.5 or 7 2 months from now? What does that do to everybody?
It's a killer.
Think it's that bad?
I mean, I agree with John, but it's. I don't think it's coming back down.
No, I'm saying, what if it keeps going up? It's going up every day now. The 10-year and the 30-year.
That's what it's going to do. Don't you think it's going up, though, because of the political scene?
I think it's going up because of the inflation's up. And people don't want... Why would you borrow? We'll lend somebody money for 30 years at 5%, if you think the inflation's 5. You're not even breaking even.
I have, you know, I don't have an answer for that. But I mean, it's going to go up, I think. I don't think we're coming out of this.
What does it do?
I'm surprised just looking around, like, you know, the West Loop and Fulton Market and those. If you just drive through there, I'm surprised there's as much construction as there is.
You know, there you go.
Just given what the numbers seem to indicate, that there'd be a lot more, you know, hesitancy to be, you know, building anything right now and expecting it to pay for itself. So I don't know. We've been down this road before where, you know, construction pretty much stopped, and some cities completely stopped, you know, for an extended period. I don't see that happening now. Maybe it should be, but it's things seem to be full speed ahead in a hospitable neighborhood where there's, you know, lots of interest and businesses and street traffic and restaurants, and you don't have to be downtown in the center of everything. You know, that seems to be kind of thriving, although I can't believe it in a way.
Well, I'm gonna lob a social commentary in here, but when you see, I'm going to say, perfectly good buildings in an area where it has tremendous transportation to get to back and forth, easy, all the train lines come here, all the CTA lines come here, the buses come here. When I say here, I mean downtown. And nobody wants any of these buildings. And people are building essentially the same stuff 2 miles to the west in an alternative downtown where...
Yeah, and in a less convenient transportation environment.
I am now, there's a reason for that, but I don't. I think that's an amazingly wobbly economic model to me. I mean, I've never seen anything like it, to be honest with you. But I could see the burbs, you know, where people just didn't want to come downtown at all. There'd be a few companies just wanted to be out there that I can get, but not a few, a lot. But the idea that you're going to have a new downtown essentially away from the train stops. It's like that says something, doesn't it? I mean, but if all of a sudden, you know, we get a mayor that straightens out some of the crime stuff, which I think, you know, and straightens some of that out, what, all those people are going to want to move downtown? They're going to say, what? Why wouldn't you want your support staff being able to get back and forth to work for $6? I mean, I don't get that. I mean, why? I mean, is there parking for all those people in the West Loop? I don't even go over there that much, but what's the point? I mean, there must be something, but I don't know if it's good, is it, Jen?
No, I think, you know, it's new or newer, and it doesn't have any of the baggage of, you know, the LaSalle Street Canyon feel or look to it, and the loneliness of it at night. I mean, there's stuff in the West Loop that pretty much, you know, is cooking most of the day and evening, and there's, you know, stuff to do. There's nightlife. There's, you know, people who are, you know, strolling around, you know, hanging out there, and that's what the Loop used to be, you know, until at least like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Not after that, but before my time, till 2 in the morning, the Loop was hopping. You know.
Well, I mean, the hotels are down here. All the people that are in town to see the city are here.
Right.
I mean, there's no. I mean, I don't know. There's not the Palmer House and the Conrad Hilton. Those kinds of places over there. It, you know, it's just kind of strange.
Which are in bankruptcy.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, it's...
Yeah, I mean, that's just... The appearance is that they're still thriving, but I think they're hanging on by a thread.
Yeah, you wonder how they are. I mean, when the prices... The rooms are 10 times... Well, I mean, how can they possibly... Who's dragging all this money out of these places?
You know, I think it's got to be, like, online booking, like, you know, travel sites or whatever, where you get a deal on a block of rooms... And if the hotel is in receivership, you know, they're happy to do this, to just get somebody in the room. And they'll have giveaway deals, you know, take it for a weekend, take it for 2 weekends, take it for the whole week. And it's going to be dirt cheap just to get somebody in there. And on paper, you would think, geez, this place is losing money hand over fist. But in their, you know, mindset, they're covering their losses. They're, you know, or at least, you know, making an attempt to do it. So I think, you know, this booking arrangements that, you know, if you went in and asked for a room that night, you get one price. If you booked it a week before on some online setup, you'd be paying one third of that. So,
yeah, John must have some kind of point, because these hotel rooms are they are filled. So it's got to be something in the arena that he's talking about.
Well, Chicago's convention, not convention, but tourist business, is that a record?
Yeah.
And I have no idea why. Because, well, when
people want to come here,
Chicago, people back up and look at you like, whoa, stay away from that person.
Well, I mean,
you can see them on North Michigan Avenue. I know they're tourists as soon as I, you know, it isn't because of how they look or their facial character, nothing. No, it's just because they're carrying bags from Ralph Lauren or whatever that, you know, Chicagoans usually don't shop at. The people who live here don't go down there to shop. And they've all got their cameras out, and they're looking up, and they're taking pictures of the skyline and having a good time. And the street is full of those people, and God bless them. Because
that's the beauty. I mean, so yeah. let me get this straight. I come to Chicago, all right? Now, this is what I should be doing one of these days. I come to Chicago. Yes. I go see Buckingham Fountain. I used to be able to go to the Board of Trade and watch the people trade, which was spectacular. Yeah. I might go to a Cubber Sox game. I'm going to go... Which, by the way, we should do this. We should go to the Museum of Science and Industry and see the Anne Frank exhibit before it's gone. You go to the Planetarium, you go to the History Museum, you go to Shedd Aquarium. It's an incredible week. You take a river tour. Where's a place nicer? Just the fact that we don't ever do it doesn't mean that it's not nice.
Right.
I mean, well, that's true. I didn't even know there was an Anne Frank exhibit.
It's supposed to be absolutely spectacular. Museum of Science. We should do a field trip.
Really?
I'll bet that's really sad. I mean, I bet it's really something to see. But, I mean, people say, hey, Chicago's a bleep hole. Well, maybe it is to some people, but I'll tell you what, it's absolutely, you can't, the tourist business is absolute record right now. I want to ask you guys, we got a dash here pretty soon, but if I would have gotten a fan, what's these... things where you can bet on anything. You can bet on how many times Jan does his sock drawer.
FanDuel?
No. I'm talking about the other ones. The ones where you...
Okay. Cash.
The ones where you can bet on politics and all that stuff.
Markets and all that, yeah.
What if I would have bet that the White Sox would have three times as many All-Stars as the Cubs. I could have got... Yeah. What odds could I have gotten on that? A zillion to one?
Yeah.
The Sox have three All-Stars. And then they didn't even pick the shortstop.
Could be tired, huh?
Yeah, they didn't even pick the shortstop. Who was their best player?
Retired.
They should have had four. And the Cubs got one.
Goodness. Who did the Cubs get?
Just PCA, Pete Crow. Who could be, you know, he's obviously one of the top five players in baseball. I mean, the guy plays center field like nobody, I've never seen him. Maybe Andrew Jones and a couple people, but he's right up there. And he hits now, which is, but the Sox have all these young players. Hey, Jen, you should know this, even though I'm going to stump the Flanagan. Sox just drafted another shortstop. What happened to the kid from Mount Carmel? They drafted number one, the shortstop. Did he just flame out, or is he somewhere else they traded him?
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking about? Was that 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
Yeah, 3 years. I think 3 years ago. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what happened.
I mean, he's supposed to be a real good kid.
Yeah.
Well, Sox, how many shortstops do the Cubs have, or the Sox have now? What, 12? Well, the beauty, like Kevin said, I was talking to him yesterday, think about a shortstop, he's usually one of the best athletes on the team, so you can move him anywhere. It's not like a shortstop can't play left field. I mean, he can. So it's interesting that all of a sudden those guys are, you know, good for them. If we could actually get a ticket someday, I wouldn't mind going, Jim, but if don't get a ticket. So, Nance, what's your prognosis here? If these rates keep creeping up, what does it do to you?
Just makes everything that, I mean, you have less clientele, less everything. I mean, let's just face it. No one's going to refinance if they don't have to. And there's been very little since, I think it's been shut off since, 21, 22, right in there. I mean, there's been no more. I mean, once the rates have gone up, people stopped at about 4.5. So how long has that been?
How are people financing the, you know, you think about the couple of new bedrooms or something, a new bathroom, that stuff's pushing, you know, 180, 220 grand. I mean, how are people financing that?
You know what? A lot of people are getting their stuff from Amazon. Like the, you know how the new soaker tubs are big and stuff.
No, I'm saying how does, if somebody decides to stay where they are, they got a nice piece of property, and they're going to put an addition on the home. It's, you know, we know people are doing this. 200 grand. Where do you get that 200 grand? Is that a second mortgage? Is that, do you refinance?
They probably refinance for that when they're done. They have to be. It's got to be something. Then they get it all off their credit cards and whatever.
So but you can't, is it, can you go get a construction loan, a second mortgage, or what are those? What do you pay for that?
That's commercial, so you're going to at least pay points up front. And then you're still going to have the money to convert it into a mortgage at the end. That's just a short-term loan, no matter what you do.
So you can't get a second mortgage for, you can't go to the bank and get another $200,000 on a second mortgage for somebody.
Not for something you're going to build. Your home would have to appraise out ahead of time for you to get it.
Really?
Yes. Otherwise, if you come in with plans and say, I want to build this, blah, 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 that. That is a short-term construction loan, and that goes commercial through the bank, and then in the end, you switch it to a mortgage when it's finished.
What if we found a place in a really nice neighborhood, and a place, you know, everybody just trashed the joint, and when we're done with it, it's worth $800. Now it's worth, you know, whatever, the wrecking ball to knock it down. Can we get a loan for the place and what we're about to do if we know that when we're done, it's going to appraise out or not? The answer, I think, is probably
still commercial.
So you can't get that. Didn't you used to be able to?
At one time, yes. But that all, you know, that has all changed.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to give the money to somebody like that. You got to give it to BlackRock. They can do it, though, right?
I have no idea.
That was a shot there, Jen. Anyway, guys, we got to go. Nance, I'll see you. Wasn't I at a nice dinner at Edgardo's on Saturday night?
That's what I heard yesterday. I was there yesterday, Saturday afternoon.
You know, it's a get a load of this. It was a 30-year record.
What does that mean?
Well, not 30 years. Well, I've been going out for, 3 years? We didn't have a dinner.
Oh.
Jack, get a load of this. They have the world's best calamari. So, so normally, plus they give you enough for like a bus. There's only two of us. So we decided, well, I was going to get a dinner. I was going to get the meatballs, which are delicious, and we were going to kind of split. Well, they bring us the meatballs, which are the size of your head. So by the time we down the meatballs and the calamari, the lady, the bartender, she loves us. She didn't put our dinner in yet. And I go, what, are you still hungry? She goes, I'm kind of stuffed. What do you say we get a dessert and bag the dinner? And we ended up getting this carrot cake, which was as big as a bus. It was absolutely delicious. So we'd ever, imagine that, the two of us not having a dinner?
This warms my heart, Tommy. Dinner experiences lately for me have been disappointments pretty much. The proportions are smaller, the weight is longer. So I don't know.
Oh, we had a great time. You get to talk to everybody there, and the bartender, she's real nice, and it's, you know, whatever. I remember we used to get two dinners and two appetizers. She goes, yeah, well, that was then. it was really good. And there's a lot of places that are doing their best to keep people there and not raising the prices and stuff and whatever. I hope they're all doing well. But anyway, I just don't like. We got to recognize what's going on here and try and stop it. And I don't see it happening. Do you guys?
No.
And I don't know. It must be benefiting somebody, but it isn't benefiting most people. Anyway, S&P futures down 23. NASDAQ futures down 305. Everything's down pretty much. Gold's down. Oil's up. Interest rates are up. Everything else is down. Be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI ProDirect. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
I think you just became my personal hero.